But if you don't have that available, the one thing I would say about education is just read any book you can get your hands on. Just, you have to read, and try to read more than you watch TV. And that's my advice when it comes to education. That's where I gained mine, was reading, just trying to spend my time in that way. Because if they don't have a way to educate, if they don't have a program for you or any schooling, then the only thing that's left is to read. And I'm sure every prison in America has a library that's full of good books that can help change your perception on the world.
So your book again, it's called The
Prison. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you again. So your book again, Nicholas, is called The Prisoner's Manifesto. And it's and then your nonprofit is called More Than an Inmate.
Yes, More Than an Inmate. I have a Facebook blog that's More Than an Inmate. And I actually have a website. It's morethananinmate.com. And my name that the book is published is Nicholas J. Ely. Ely is spelled E-L-Y. And yes, More Than an Inmate is really the main focus that I'm really trying to press the idea that reform starts with us in here. And I hope that if we change who we are, that society will give us a second chance.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. Just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Hey everybody, it's Greg McVicker, creator of Undercurrents. Glad you're listening. This is KBOO 90.7, Portland.
Tune into KBOO every third Saturday at 10 p.m. for Query.
Dive into the spectrum of queer music as we explore artists across time and genre.
She's on my mind every hour of every day.
That's Query, every third Saturday at 10 p.m.
The things we could do, oh, it takes my breath away.
Here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And I lose control, think I follow home.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
There was a show at Pine Street, and it was, I think, Ken Miske and Kyle Brewster was their band, and it was called Machine. I tried not to go to skinhead shows, but it turned out to be this massive skinhead crazy thing. And they were like singing their crappy music, and they were all rioting and shouting and stuff. And I remember being there, and I had Doc Martens. You know, the big thing to wear was Doc Martens. And I had a nice pair of Lady Docs that I'd bought. I was 16, and I wasn't a big kid at all. And I remember them coming up to me, these girls. They were like in their probably 22 and like, why are you wearing white boots? Mind you, these are black leather boots. And I was like, they look black to me. But I remember sitting up on the stage because I was scared. I mean, there was a lot of them there and I was like trying to watch my back. But on the stage, there's the skinhead band. I remember trying to get out. They actually had to sneak me out of Pine Street because they'd kicked a bunch of skinheads out because they were fighting. They were outside chanting, kill the nigger. They're talking about me. They were talking about me. I was this little black girl and that's what they were chanting, you know? So the bouncers got worried and there was a group of people there that I knew, and they put a trench coat over me and stuck me out to this car. The guy's car wouldn't start. He got out. I think the driver, he was actually like Chinese or Asian. He went out. They didn't want him. And I was in the back seat. I had two people on either side of me. There were skinhead bodies all over the car. They all had their straps. Their bodies were plastered onto the car. They got a bat. They were trying to hit the window, and the guy's car wouldn't start. They broke the windows. Seriously, everybody in that car got like punched or hit except for me. Finally, the car started, thank God, and we drove across Burnside back downtown. I mean, those people really saved my life. This is a week before they killed Mulugeta Sarraw. Okay, so this stuff was already brewing.
mob scene could have happened anywhere and at any time in this racist empire known as America, but for China, the black woman being interviewed about her punk rock youth, this was Portland, Oregon in 1988. Stories like China's, stories of violence at punk shows, and outright racism were pretty common here back then.
In November of 1988, when China got hustled into that car, about 400,000 people lived here, and about 85% of them were white. The average cost of a single-family home was $76,000, though that would soon rise astronomically. Oregon's minimum wage in 1988 was $3.35. The average rent for a room at the time was around $100 a month. Pizza was $1 a slice. Young punk rockers in 1988 barely needed to work part-time to pay for a place to stay or for a new pair of lady docks, which left a lot of time for hanging out. And the kids hung out downtown, which after 5 p.m. cleared out and was left to the hobos, the cops, drunks, drug dealers, street kids, punk rockers, and skinheads.
At the time, Portland had a lot of skinheads. They were often working-class kids who were attracted to the camaraderie, the stripped-down uniform, the menacing look, and the simple rhetoric. A shaved head, a bomber jacket, combat boots, suspenders, working-class pride, and an embracing of violence. By the late 1980s, white supremacists started recruiting this local population, and Portland became referred to as Skin City, a haven for racist youth. Skinheads roamed downtown, northwest, and southeast Portland in a drug and alcohol-enhanced search for targets. Gays, men who did not fit masculine standards, interracial couples, lone punks, immigrants, indigenous people, and black Portlanders all fit the bill. Anyone who attended a local punk or even rock show in the 80s knew that they might encounter violence at the hands of these bullies. The risk of violence was the price to pay for music fans in order to access the scene that kept their souls alive in the grim little city known to punks in those days as Doomtown.
Then, late one night in November 1988, racist skinheads attacked a group of Ethiopian immigrants as they chatted in a car outside their apartment building in the southeast working class Kearns neighborhood. 28-year-old Mulugeta Sarah got out of the car to fight with his friends against the boneheads and went down under a baseball bat and multiple kicks from his three assailants, who left him for dead. Three young men, ages 19, 23, and 24, were his executioners. They were not outside agitators. They were a punk rocker, a homecoming king with substance use issues, and a street kid. They were restless, homegrown racists itching for a fight on a Saturday night, egged on by their girlfriends and drunk on hate.
It Did Happen Here tells the story of an unlikely collaboration between groups of activists, immigrants, militant youth, and queer organizers who use a diversity of tactics to confront blatant white supremacy. I'm Mike Crenshaw.
And I'm Selena Flores. This is the story of how, 30 years ago, neo-Nazis were chased off the streets of the Rose City. This is a people's history, not an academic research project, but the lived experiences of how people here became actively anti-fascist.
So let's go back to the 1980s punk scene, a place frequented by underage kids looking for an edge to test ourselves in the streets, a place where we could feel alive in the years of Reaganomics. Here's China again, and Michael Clark, who spent his youth as a white kid in the punk rock and skate scenes.
I was born and raised in Portland. I grew up first in North and Northeast Portland, and that was actually our black neighborhood. My mom moved us downtown to go to school.
Downtown was a totally different story. The Greyhound station used to be on the other side of town, and they had the wall, which was on the backside of the courthouse. And 13 years old, you could buy any drug known to mankind there.
Portland was smaller. I remember when they were building Pioneer Square. Before Pioneer Square, there was a place called The Wall that people used to hang out on. This is way back, even in the 70s.
Portland was such a small-time city that the best place for kids to hang out those days was literally a stone wall in downtown Portland, where people bought drugs, took drugs, checked out each other's outfits, listened to the newest hardcore tape on a crappy boombox, and met up. Nowadays, downtowns are privatized, enclosed, curated, and policed. The Wall in downtown Portland back then was an unofficial public space, the free square on the Monopoly board, where all types of downtown misfits gathered.
everybody was intermixed. We had like the 80s rockers, right? Total death metal guys, cliques of that, lots of punk rockers. And at the time, 86, 87, the only skinheads that I knew of were white power skinheads.
If you ask the punks and skins at the time what kind of music they listened to, you might hear, to paraphrase the Blues Brothers, "We like both kinds of music, punk and metal." The nascent local thrash scenes with bands like Wehrmacht or Dead Conspiracy comfortably shared bills with local punk bands like Poison Idea and national metal acts like Slayer. Either way, between 1985 and 1990, you could pretty much count on Nazi skins showing up at most underground rock shows.
I knew skinheads from being out at shows and from being in the punk rock skate scene. Everything I knew about them at the time was that everywhere they went, there was trouble. That you better have friends with you if you were going to run into them. And it was definitely violent wherever they were. My personal experiences with them, 13, 14, New Pair of Docks, walking down Woodstock Boulevard, and two carloads of guys pull up, hey, little, you know, yelling at me, give up the boots, and getting chased through Southeast Portland. Also, gangs were really big. I went to Madison and Grant High Schools, so we had a lot of diversity. Bloods, Crips, different Hispanic gangs, Asian gangs, and a lot of guns and a lot of violence.
Violence isn't new to this formerly sleepy little city at the confluence of the Willamette and Columbia Rivers. At the dawn of the 20th century, Portland was one of the most dangerous port cities on the West Coast. And in the late 20th century, it was still pretty dangerous.
There was a stereotype back then of punks being menacing, crazy, out of control, and violent, terrorizing old ladies on the bus. The reality was being a punk on the bus in 1988 made you a target. From other teenagers, from homophobes, from rednecks, from cops, from jocks. If you were a punk, you dressed and looked the way you did as a fuck you to society. And a lot of society took the message and said, fuck you, right back. So take all of that, and in China's case, compounded by being a 14-year-old black girl, and try to imagine the hostility she faced for just existing.
I like punk rock music. I got exposed to it. I think I was listening to alternative radio. They would play some Vandals and just old school punk rock. So I was listening to the music. And growing up as a black kid in Portland, Oregon, you know, I'd already experienced being disenfranchised, experienced being excluded. So, you know, I think I just naturally started questioning society and questioning what was acceptable. And I started to kind of formulate ideas like questioning the system. So the music appealed to me, the style appealed to me. And, you know, being a kid, I didn't have money. So punk rock style was something that I could access. Everyone at my school was wearing like Guess jeans and expensive stuff. I didn't have money like that. I was coming from a single parent family. We just didn't have money. So then when I started to interact with people and stuff, there was a lot of talk. It was mostly white kids, all white kids. I'm saying mostly. Mm-hmm. And people would talk, you know, say the N-word a lot. And then I remember them saying, well, not you. It was a real uncomfortable feeling. It didn't feel good. And I always felt, you know, like unsafe.
And racist incidents in the punk scene became a regular part of China's teenage life.
When I first came downtown, I remember these three girls, and they were all older than me. I was like 13 or 14. Mm-hmm. They said that I stole the bus pass to buy dope. I didn't even know what dope was. That's how naive and dumb I was. And so these girls started attacking me, you know? They jumped me. Being the kid that I was, I mean, I was like scared at first, but I just got in. I mean, I fought back. And somebody hits me, I'm not going to stand there and be hit. So I gained respect, but that's always just hurt my heart because I was just a naive kid. I didn't want to fight anybody. I didn't steal from nobody, you know? So I gained respect right there just because I was able to fight. And that's what it was like in the beginning, being part of this scene.
There was a prevalence of white supremacist attitudes. There was like this group, Eastside White Pride, and a lot of the people that were affiliated with them weren't like shaved bald, but they would have like long hair. They're kind of white people that were basically racist, like most white people, you know. They're just more blatant, probably more real with it. That's where the Nazi skinhead movement evolved from in Portland. I was with a friend of mine, and three men called me the N-word. My friend was older, and he was like, hold on. And he took a skateboard, and he just hit him upside the head. And they hit me with a bottle, and I'm like, you know. But he just cracked him upside the head with a skateboard, and we're like really fighting. So this was happening because of who I was, a black girl
I was a kid with nowhere to live. I didn't have any education. Nobody was listening to me. I was getting police brutality. I was getting skinhead brutality. I had to be strong as fuck, okay? I had to be so strong.
I grew up in the Portland area. I spent a lot of my youth tearing around downtown, skateboarding, and was involved in the punk rock scene, especially from 85, 86 on.
That's Jason, who later organized with the group Anti-Racist Action, or ARA. We're going to hear from him throughout the podcast.
There were quite a few traditional or oi skins that were not racialized. It was very fluid.
Oi or traditional skinheads is a classification that comes out of the UK skinhead scene. As the skinhead scene became more partisan, communists and anarchists on the left, fascists on the right, traditional skins tried to take the middle path. They were class conscious and nationalistic, but otherwise apolitical. As fascist violence increased, this middle path became increasingly untenable.
Some of them went white power, some of them on the fringes or still hung out but didn't get quite as involved. Other people were wearing crossed out swastikas, but they all still knew each other. They were still part of this loose fabric. I was still just a punk kid going to shows and didn't know a whole lot of those people personally. I'd met a few through going to treatment and aftercare programs and what like that as a teenager, and then witnessing them becoming racialized. They definitely started to make a presence at shows, and there would be confrontations between skinheads that had become white power and those that were still on the fringes, and like, you better, you know, figure it out or get in line or don't show up with that crossed out swastika next time I see you. But nothing had really, really moved too rapidly. And then there was a beating of a guy downtown, an Asian man, and there was a few other incidents that happened, and it just started getting worse and worse. So often they would spend the show just beating each other up or beating up anyone that got in their way. And then it grew to where there'd be 10 to 20 of them. They stepped up their recruitment efforts. So the old Pine Street Theater, 9th and Pine, that and the old Starry Night down on 6th and West Burnside were the two big clubs that they made presences at.
The Asian man Jason mentions was 27-year-old Singapore native Hak Sing Sam Chin. In March of 1988, three skinheads harassed him and his family outside a downtown restaurant, yelling, "Get out of the country!" An anti-immigrant taunt that we still hear today from Proud Boys and other racists. Chin stood his ground and was not severely hurt. But in a news article from May of 1988, the City of Portland's refugee coordinator dismissed the attack on Chin, saying racist skinheads were not a threat to Portland's immigrant populations.
Over and over, people who survive attacks have called for redress, only to have the experiences be brushed off as isolated incidents. The pattern where police and city government ignore lived experiences of marginalized people creates an environment in which skinheads in the 80s and racists today are able to have space and power. This pattern of downplaying racist attacks in Portland reflects the deep white supremacy at the roots of the city and of the nation. Here's Joran, another white punk kid from Portland who became part of Anti-Racist Action.
The big impact was going to shows, which first of all were significantly fewer back then. So, you know, we were pretty excited if we had a good show to go to once a month. Pine Street Theater was one of the main venues that we would go see either local or touring bands. My recollection was it was always kind of scary. Early on, I have less of a recollection of political orientation being as much of an issue. We didn't really think of them as boneheads or Nazi skinheads. They were just skinheads, and they were typically bigger. They were often older, and they were bullies. One of the elements was like, were they going to ask us what size our shoes were? I remember being probably 14 or 15 years old and being outside Satyricon in Old Town and seeing a kid get curbed for his boots. kind of from that point on, was always terrified that something like that could happen to anyone.
To give a little more perspective on how skinheads impacted the local scene, here's a letter to the editor sent in May of 1988 to Willamette Week, Portland's alternative news weekly.
Skins do a lot of their gathering at concerts and shows where they intimidate everyone from the door person to the kids watching the performance. They travel and fight in packs. It's hard for even the largest door person or bouncer to repel 20 skins who descend on the door at once, demanding to be let in for lower prices, or ignoring the fact that they've been 86th from a venue for causing violence in the past. In the pit at hardcore shows, male skins gang up on individuals who looked at them funny and slash innocent people with their spiked rings. Female skins beat up girls in the bathroom at Pine Street Theater with no provocation whatsoever. The skinheads drink outside the venues where there are shows, increasing the need for paid security outside as well as inside the club. They carry baseball bats with swastikas on them, knives, brass knuckles, etc. How can a club owner or employee ever criticize one skinhead without the fear of having all the establishment's windows broken by the gang? You can't throw out one violent skinhead without incurring the wrath and retribution of all the skinheads. Before almost every hardcore show, rumors ran rampant about who or what the skins are going up against on this particular night. I have heard them threatening people who dared to stand up to them, that they would kill them next time they encountered them on the street. No matter how hollow these threats may turn out to be, it's terrifying to the lone individual who actually does see skins on the street every day. The escalation of the number of skinheads in Portland in the last 2 years is absolutely staggering. It's amazing how cool it has become to dress in a bomber jacket and boots, purchase a screwdriver t-shirt and a few albums. I've lost count of how many kids I've seen shave their heads and adopt the uniform in just the past few months. I cannot believe that they are all ignorant of the political beliefs that go along with the outfit, and it seems likely that at least some of them will be joining their lookalikes in gang-type intimidation in the future. Please do not print my name or address. If you publish this letter, just sign me, Intimidated.
Let's not forget the foundations of all of this. Oregon's history as a state deliberately constructed by its settler founders as a Protestant white homeland. Despite the strong presence of the city's militant left-wing culture, Portland was still an overgrown backwoods town full of rednecks and racist cops. Where white supremacy was and still is upheld by decree, vigilante violence, and institutionalized oppression. Portland is also geographically isolated. San Francisco is a 12-hour drive. Seattle is 4 hours away. At the time, plane tickets were expensive and everyone had a crappy car, and bus travel was excruciating. As a result, Portland has tended to turn inward and developed a vibrant and unique alternative culture. In the late 70s and early 80s, the first wave of punk swept through Portland, giving us the Wipers, who rose to national prominence, fronted by a lead singer and lyricist, Greg Sage, a gay man. Fred and Tootie Cole from The Rats and later Dead Moon grew out of the 1960s hippie and anti-war countercultures. A pair of teenage sisters led the band The Neo Boys. Portland's original punk scene, like a lot of early punk scenes in the U.S., was experimental, home to queer people and women who offset cliches, weirdos who brought an art vibe, self-described mutants and other folks who didn't fit in with mainstream culture. By the mid-1980s, many of these original punks supported the scene off the stage. They worked at record stores, designed posters, established and staffed 21 and over punk venues like Satyricon and Blue Gallery, and DJed late-night radio shows.
It was quite a different scene by the mid-80s. Years of the Reagan administration's vicious policies against the poor, the mentally ill, and single moms, among others, along with the rise of the Christian right, sharpened tensions. The teenage punks of 1987 were angrier and even more alienated than their artsy predecessors. Their music was faster, more aggressive. Poison Idea, a local band who formed in 1980, specialized in alienation, nihilism, and self-destruction. They played with blistering speed and rabid intensity. In the mid-80s, they were the only local band that mattered, the Kings of Portland Punk.
During the 80s, barely any kind of the alternative culture people lived east of 39th. You could be an artist. You could live on a few hundred dollars a month. And that was a lot of the reason for the vibrancy of the scene. There was some space and latitude.
Patrick Mazza covered Portland's changing music scene and was one of the few local writers who wrote about hardcore. Mazza was a white activist and journalist in his 30s during the late 80s. He wrote a music column for a left-wing newspaper that was published and edited by his late brother Dave, called the Portland Alliance.
Portland had gotten a national reputation for being a place where skinheads could come, and, you know, even among the punk community, there was this weird tolerance for intolerance. For a city of our size, we had the most skinheads per capita. I mean, it was like skinhead capital. Skins came from typically poor and lower class backgrounds. They were not prosperous people, so a lot of young white people who felt vulnerable joined for common defense. We know the history of Oregon, the Klan history of the 20s, the bar on black people living in Oregon. So that kind of racist white undercurrent was still there. And so they could kind of mesh in, you know, with the rest of the working class. And they came in and did indoctrination. The Aryan Nations people came in and said, well, you know why you're all screwed up. It's all those blacks and Jews. It's all those people taking your jobs, and it's not your fault. And so you got an increasing ideological element to it. They were beating up on black people, beating up on gays. This was going on for a number of years.
One of the punks indoctrinated by Nazi organizers was a former street kid named Ken Mieske, also known as Ken Death. Ken Death was a charismatic musician in Portland's hardcore scene who worked a security job at punk venues. We mentioned his band at the beginning of this episode, when China escaped the mob of racists. By 1988, when Ken was 24, he was running with the skinhead crew, Eastside White Pride.
Ken Mieske was a visceral guy who was violent. That's what got him to be security chief at Monkey Productions at Pine Street Theater. The first I saw Ken Mieske was in this short that Gus Van Sant had done, that he showed at an event with William Burroughs. It was quite a night. It was an amazing night. Then my next encounters was when I became a music columnist for Portland Alliance.
In 1986, Patrick helped organize a benefit show at the Pine Street Theater to raise funds to support closing the Hanford nuclear waste dump on the Columbia River.
We decided to, stage this benefit at Pine Street. The people at Monkey Productions, who were running Pine Street at the time, said, you better get good security. We really didn't know what was coming at us. Originally, it was supposed to be MDC, it stands for Millions of Dead Cops, BGK from Netherlands, and Cheetah Chrome from Italy.
Cheetah Chrome is a punk guitarist who was most known for playing in the Dead Boys. The band from Italy that played this show was actually called Cheetah Chrome Motherfuckers. When Mazza says Cheetah Chrome, he means Cheetah Chrome Motherfuckers, the band.
As the rumblings about the show got into the air, MDC said, no, we're not going to come. Night of the show, the skinheads turned up in large numbers, 60 or something like that. Ken Mieske, Ken Death, who was security chief for Monkey, he let some of his friends in. Our person working the door let some of them in. They did get their baseball bats at the door. When Cheetah Chrome opened, they started Sieg Heiling. The lead singer for Cheetah Chrome said, we're not going to play. Our fathers died fighting your kind of scum. We're not going to play for you. All of a sudden, the entire floor disintegrates into little clustering, arguing groups of people. People arguing with the skinheads. This was 1986. This is my Portland Alliance column. The next day, I was told that a number of local bands are going to do the same as Cheetah Chrome, refuse to play when people are pulling Nazi crap in the audience. We spent the next couple of days with band members. Antonio of Cheetah Chrome told me that even though the group didn't get to play, it was the best show they ever had. Cheetah Chrome wants something beyond music, he said. They want communication with the audience and something that will change people's lives. They gave people some inspiration to stand up. That did not set off the wave against the Nazis. It took the killing of Mulligan of Syrah to do that.
Thanks for listening to this episode of It Did Happen Here. The transcripts, show notes with links, full credits, and other relevant content can be found at our website, itdidhappenherepodcast.com. Interviews for this episode were by Barbara Bernstein, Selena Flores, Aaron Yankee, and Mike Crenshaw, and your hosts were Mike Crenshaw and Selena Flores. It Did Happen Here is produced by Mike, Selena, and me, Aaron Yankee. Thanks to the participants for sharing their stories. Thanks also to the Institute for Anarchist Studies, PM Press, the Marla Davis Fund, KBOO Community Radio, and the rest of our production team, Icky A., Julie Perini, and Mo Baustern. And thank you for listening.
You're tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting right with it.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
He was an Ethiopian immigrant. He'd come here, and I guess he was a college student. You know, I don't know him personally at all, but I mean, that's just an innocent person, you know, who came here for school and a better life, and these guys killed him.
The crime took place here on Southeast 31st early Sunday morning. 3 black men, all from Ethiopia, were sitting in this car talking. When one left to head for his apartment, another car pulled up, 3 young white men jumped out and began beating him. There were also 2 women with the 3 skinheads, women who stayed in their car but who shouted encouragement.
They never say anything, just the girls are screaming inside and they say, kill, you know, kill him or beat him, you know.
Dead is 27-year-old Mulligeta Sarau.
We're all hanging out at this apartment on 21st Street. There was like 20 of us. Someone brought the news that they'd killed somebody, those people that we'd been fighting. And it was like this silence. We were all like, oh my God, this is real. Ish, this is real. We knew that it was, but having someone killed like that, I mean, and it was like a sadness and kind of like we realized that what we'd actually been fighting was something that we totally needed to fight.
The murder of Mulligeta Syrah hit the city hard. Even today, many Portlanders remember the moment when they first heard the news. People who lived in the Kearns neighborhood, site of the murder, were shocked to learn of their racist neighbors. This was not shocking to black and queer Portlanders, indigenous people, immigrants, and punks, all targets of the young neo-Nazi gangs. City leaders could no longer gaslight frightened teens or marginalized populations. It was the beginning of a civic defense that would forever change Portland. Welcome to episode 2 of It Did Happen Here, the murder of Mulugeta Sarraw. I'm Mike Crenshaw, your host for this episode.
A young man named Mulugeta Sarraw, who was an Ethiopian student at Portland State University, was beaten to death by neo-Nazi skinheads on the streets of Southeast Portland.
That's Scott Nakagawa, an activist and organizer. We'll be hearing from him a lot throughout this podcast.
Those neo-Nazi activists were affiliated with a group called Eastside White Pride, and they in turn were affiliated with a national organization called the White Aryan Resistance, which was led by a man named Tom Metzger, who was a former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, and many suspected a member of an underground neo-Nazi group called the Order that was involved in a number of famous murders and millions of dollars of burglaries of mainly of armored cars. We understood this group was very dangerous. A couple of their members were surprised people in the community. One was the leader of a popular Portland band. He was a big cultural figure in the alternative music scene here, who was known by the name Ken Death. He actually was the star of a short film by the filmmaker Gus Van Sant called Ken Death Gets Out of Jail. So, you know, I had some familiarity with Ken and the circle that he moved in. So that was a bit of a surprise, though not as much as the surprise that Carl Brewster presented us. Carl Brewster, who was from an upper middle class family and whose mother was a progressive social activists in the city. So, you know, these things that defied stereotypes, these young men who brutally, really brutally beat Mulugeta Sarraw to death with baseball bats and by kicking him, and for nothing, for some dispute over parking or something, shocked the city. Shocked the city that these were not your stereotypical street thugs, that they were highly sophisticated political thinkers, that they had national affiliations, and that they, you know, specifically were who they were.
The news of the murder deeply impacted the punk community. We bring back punks Joran and China from the last episode to share their experiences.
They had moved from just being bullies of our scene to political actors that were capable of murder. They meant business. And I think it mobilized a lot of us to start being a little less passive, and we needed to do something.
There were some people that were sent up here. I feel like Tom Metzger sent them. They were like White Aryan Nations or whatever. They sent up here and they had hits out on a couple of us. And so there were like street fights. And I remember there was a concert, a bunch of us were there, and then these Nazis showed up and they even had tasers. It was nuts.
Portland's power base, political, economic, educational, they did not respond well or quickly enough to skinheads.
That's Ron Herndon, one of the most well-known activists in Portland. Ron Herndon had been a student radical at Reed College and later founded Portland's chapter of the Black United Front. Herndon had decades of experience in organizing in Portland's tightly knit Black community, particularly around issues of race equity in Portland schools throughout the 1980s.
It's almost as if you see that you've got a cut on your hand and it's not healing well and you ignore it. And then you wonder why you got poison streaming throughout your arm and then now it's spreading throughout your body. Mm. Something should have been done when you saw the cut. And when this organization of those who espouse that racist dogma, when it first came to town, they putting out their little flyers and hate statements, there should have been a far more assertive response to that then. And I think that's the danger, that when this pops up, and it's quite cyclical, when it pops up, that there has to be an immediate strong response from every possible segment of society to it. And if we ignore that, and we ignore it at our own peril.
Again, here's Scott Nakagawa.
The racist right in the United States is a permanent feature of American politics and requires constant vigilance. So that was something we learned, and we learned very quickly. We learned how long the history was of many of the white nationalist groups that were active here in Oregon. We learned about the influence of groups like the Posse Comitatus here in Oregon that goes back decades. The Posse Comitatus, whose ideology was basically a blueprint for the Bundy Uprising and the occupation of the bird sanctuary in Malheur County. these kinds of groups and ideas have always been a part of the political mix, have always been limiting our democratic potential here, have always targeted communities of color, women, religious minorities, and have always been able to play a really significant role in determining what political outcomes we will have here in Oregon, all the way around the country. In studying that history, also saw, for example, that the Ku Klux Klan was very active here in the 1920s. That at one point, I believe it's true, that about 1 in 3 white men in the city of Portland belonged to the Ku Klux Klan. The Ku Klux Klan here played the kingmaker in one Oregon election, helping to decide who the governor would be. And were really active in trying to close down Catholic parochial schools. Their influence is something we still feel here. One of the reasons why we have such a robust public school system here in Oregon relative to many other places is because of the activity of the Klan. Part of the reason why we have such a powerful free speech clause in our Constitution is in part the influence of the Ku Klux Klan. And so, you know, they are part and parcel of the story of Oregon. They are part of the history here. And so we should never behave as if, because they become less visible, they've gone away. In fact, they've always been here.
Racism has extremely deep roots in Oregon. Uprooting white supremacy requires long-term strategizing and relationship building to create community and coalition locally, nationally, and internationally. Black Portland had been building these kinds of coalitions for decades. Here's Ron Herndon again describing the community events supporting African liberation struggles.
During the late 60s, all during the 70s, every year there was a big march and rally here in Portland called African Liberation Day. And it was to support African countries who at that time were still suffering from colonialism and apartheid. And that event every year was meant to bring attention to that, give support to the liberation movements. Black people here in Portland who sent supplies, clothes back to those countries. The communities were intertwined. There were efforts made between members of both communities to learn from each other, to support each other, celebrate, and worked with each other, invited people to their various events, holiday celebrations. So I think that's why it made it very easy for the Ethiopian community to reach out to us. I remember getting a phone call the day after he had been murdered, and someone from the Ethiopian community that I knew said that we need help. We don't know what to do. Can you come and meet his uncle and other members of the community? So we said yes. There were about 4 of us who went to this apartment over not too far from here in Southeast Portland. And what I remember walking in the room is all these women who were just crying. And met his uncle, and he asked us what we could do. We said, well, one of the things we can do is we can have a press event to draw attention to this, and we'll have a rally demonstration. So we did that. We had a press event, and we got him in touch with an attorney so that he would know what he could safely say and what he probably shouldn't say in terms of what was going to happen going forward with the police investigation. So we did that. And we had the rally on the steps of City Hall. We had a couple hundred people who came out from the white community, black community, and the Hispanic community to bring attention to what happened and to demand that justice be served.
We'll hear now from Ingeda Berhanu, Mulugeta Sarah's uncle. The speech was recorded at the Mulugeta Sarah Commemoration Conference, sponsored by the Urban League of Portland to honor Mulugeta on the 30th anniversary of his murder and to study the history of anti-Black violence in Oregon.
Anytime I speak about Mulugeta, I get emotional. I like to be emotional because he means a lot to me. Here we go. When I arrived in the U.S. from Ethiopia on a student visa in March 1973, I had no plan to remain in the U.S. My plan was to return home immediately after I completed my education. In fact, I was so eager to return home that I received my degree in journalism from Walla Walla College, now Walla Walla University, in 3 years, in 1976. After I graduated, I was offered a position as director of the Seventh-day Adventist Publishing House in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, where I worked as a translator and editor before I left for the U.S. When I wrote my father to tell him the good news that I was returning home as a big shot, I did not expect his reaction. He told me not to return home at that time. He said it was not safe for me to do so. You see, in 1976, Ethiopia was in the middle of a raging civil war. People were being killed in the streets randomly, especially young men. Instead, my father told me to send for my brothers and my nephew to bring them to the U.S., where he thought they would be safer. After a few years of indecision, not knowing when I would be able to return home, it dawned on me that chances of my returning to Ethiopia were getting slimmer and slimmer. I decided to go to graduate school in the U.S. In 1979, I enrolled in the Department of Sociology at Portland State University on this very campus. It was at that time I received letters from my nephew Mulugeta Srau and from one of my brothers letting me know that they had graduated from high school and wanted to come to the U.S. to further their education. By then, I had met and befriended a very kind couple, Clarence and Elsie Tupper, who lived in Goldendale, Washington. They were willing to sponsor Mulugeta and my brother. I sent Mulugeta and my brother I-20s, that's International College Acceptance Letters. Mulugeta completed the process and arrived in Portland in December 1980. I cannot explain the happiness we both felt when I picked him up at the airport. We had not seen each other since Mulugeta was a small boy. I marveled at how he had grown up into a handsome young man. You see, Mulugeta and I have always had a special bond. He was the second child and the first son of my beloved older sister, Fetanech Brahanu. She was the person I loved more than anyone else because she cared for my younger siblings and me when our young mother died. Unfortunately, she died at a young age too. I felt it was my turn to help her children now. I was happy to have the opportunity to help Mulugeta. Mulugeta moved in with me in my apartment in Beaverton, and he proved to be a very responsible young man. He quickly found a job at a fast food restaurant, later at a small Catholic school in Beaverton. He became a favorite of both the students and the staff, the teachers. He was hardworking, caring, kind, and respectful. He also made a circle of friends among the small community of Ethiopians and Americans alike. He quickly was acknowledged as a leader and a peacemaker. He was also an avid soccer player. When I decided to move to California in January 1982 and suggested that he join me in my move, he politely declined. He said he liked it in Portland. He has his friends, his job, his school. He assured me that he could take care of himself. During the following years, Mulugeta and I, my family kept in close contact. We would attend relative weddings and other major events together. He would visit my family in California frequently during the holidays, and I would visit him in Portland occasionally. In the process, he and my young daughter established a very special bond during his frequent visit. She just loved his beautiful smile and sweet personality. The last time I saw Mulugeta was during a Labor Day weekend in 1988. A couple of months before they were murdered, when we attended a relative's wedding in Walla Walla, Washington. He was very happy and is still going to school. Then I received a phone call on that fateful Sunday morning at 5 o'clock on November 13, 1988. The voice on the other end of the line said that Mulugeta was hurt in a fight early that morning. But intuitively, I knew that something had gone terribly wrong because Mulugeta was never a fighter. He always tried to stop fights. Even when he was murdered, he was not fighting, but he was trying to stop the fight between his friends and the skinheads. This selfless act demonstrates the true nature of Mulugeta's heart, even in the face of danger. My beloved Mulugeta Serao lived as a peacemaker and died as a peacemaker. Thank you.
That was Engada Berhanu, Mulugeta Serao's uncle, recorded at the conference hosted by the Urban League to commemorate the 30th anniversary of Mulugeta's murder. Now we'll hear recordings from an event hosted by Enrique Rivera and sponsored by the Multnomah County Library. We'll start with my co-host, Mike Crenshaw.
Something that occurred to me is that during the production of the podcast, there have been a few times at which we've had to acknowledge that Mulugeta is a human being, was a human being, and was not just a victim of a racist murder. When you listen to his uncle talk, if you're an empathic, you know, sentient being, you're going to be moved. And that's what we're talking about. You know, we're dealing with people who are also human, but for whatever reasons, based on programming, fear, conditioning, trauma, I don't know, you know, it's not my job to figure that out. But what I do understand is that they don't recognize the humanity of other humans. And the reason they're oriented towards white supremacy and racism and fascism is to protect their right to exist at the expense of everyone else. And that's the root of what we're dealing with. And that we have to acknowledge that, you know, because I think there's a lot of debate around, well, free speech, and if you try to limit a person from speaking their point of view, aren't you just being fascist yourself? Sometimes liberals level that critique towards those of us who are anti-fascist and anti-racist. But we have to remember, and this is something that Marty said, one of the brothers that's interviewed in the podcast, he said, you know, their freedom of speech denies us our right to exist.
This is a clip that didn't originally make it in the podcast. You'll hear me interviewing Leonard Zeskind, human rights activist and founder of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. What do you see are the similarities between groups from the early 90s and groups now that are organizing on the right?
Well, the groups that are organizing now are younger than, you know, the folks that picked up the ball in the 80s and 90s had been around for a while. And now we've got a bunch of young people. And quite frankly, we've got a problem on our hands. And it's big.
Yeah.
The problem is big. And it's bigger than anybody realizes it, because we're at the beginning of it. And I can't stress that enough. This is a huge issue.
Yeah.
And it's not going away quickly. Look, we have a fight on our hands, and people are pretending that it's, you know, 4 minutes of battle and they'll get it done. And that ain't that way. We're in deep, and we got to get prepared for, you know, the next generation of battles, and we're not doing it.
What do you think it would take to be prepared?
Smarter.
So more intelligence gathering, that type of thing?
Well, more intelligence gathering, but smarter. act like there's a battle going on,
mm-hmm.
and build towards tomorrow.
What do you think that looks like?
What would that be like?
Yeah.
Multi-year funding would help. That would be one thing that would help a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And doing things aimed at tomorrow's young people. That's what would help.
Mm-hmm.
Getting ready for the, you know, we're fighting the battles now that we have to fight because we have to fight them.
Yeah.
And the way to do it.
It sounds like you think that there's a much larger event coming. Can you speak to that more?
Well, look, the white supremacists have been organizing against immigrants since David Duke staged a Klan watch, staged a militia of armed white supremacists on the border with Mexico in the 1970s. Aryan nations in the 1980s used to hand out maps about the big immigration flow with big red arrows in 83 and 84, and I got a copy that I picked up in Kansas, rural Kansas. And it's been a long time on their agenda.
Mm-hmm.
They have been paying attention to the calendar. They know with certainty that there's a battle to come, and they've been acting like it.
Mm-hmm.
You hear their slogan that immigration is white genocide. It's because white people will lose their power through a majority dominance. Now, frankly, I think that's a good thing, but they don't, and there's a lot of white people who agree with them. I think it's 55%. I think the number is 55%. I've written it down a billion times. The high number of white people who think black people are oppressing them. There's massive misinformation and false consciousness out there.
Mm-hmm.
And on the coast, it's not as big to see, but it exists on the coast too.
Mm-hmm.
Exist in the Portland area, and this battle is going to get tough when a majority of people are no longer white. It's they're a minority in a nation of minorities.
Yeah, I saw recently that the number of children or babies of color was larger this year than white babies.
You bet, Red Ryder. That's what's coming down the pike. And they've been playing this ball that white people are dispossessed. They've been saying that since 72, these white supremacists.
Mm-hmm.
Now they got a chance to say, yeah, there's more of them than there is of us. They're destroying our culture. And they're finding followers.
Mm-hmm.
And we think we're going to beat it out of them? No, we got to get education out into every hand.
Mm-hmm. So do you think it's more about winning the hearts and minds than actually like combat, like physical combat?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a battle for hearts and minds.
So this was a clip that I chose. It was actually not in the podcast proper. This is Leonard Zeskind. He's a Jewish man, a scholar, and he's been an organizer around fighting white nationalism for decades. And he was somebody that was referred to us by several of the people from the Coalition for Human Dignity. And I chose this clip because it wasn't included in the podcast, but I think the content is very important. It kind of haunted me. And I'm always looking for kind of what's next, what can I do, what can we do? And I think that what Leonard is speaking to here about winning the hearts and minds of people, and not to say that we don't need other methods and strategies and tactics, but I think that's a huge piece. And also what he mentioned about kids and organizing toward the future. And I heard multiple people throughout the podcast mention education. And I just think that that part is so important, and I wanted to emphasize that.
Thank you, Selena.
Thanks for listening to this episode of It Did Happen Here. The transcripts, show notes with links, full credits, and other relevant content can be found at our website, itdidhappenherepodcast.com. Interviews for this episode were by Selena Flores, Ender Black, Aaron Yankee, Mike Crenshaw, and Eugene Rashad. And your hosts were Mike Crenshaw and Selena Flores. It Did Happen Here is produced by Mike, Selena, and me, Aaron Yankee. Thanks to the participants for sharing their stories. Thanks also to Lindsay Runyon and Enrique Rivera of the Multnomah County Library, the Institute for Anarchist Studies, PM Press, the Marla Davis Fund, KBOO Community Radio, and to the rest of our production team, Icky A., Julie Perini, and Mo Baustern. And thank you for listening.
Listening to KBOO Portland. Stupid, you'll be a real mean guy.